Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 297 of the Roguecast, recorded July 7th, 2020. Hopefully I'll have it before the fire channel exists.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. Yeah. And it's a little bit different because I've killed Randy and taken his place.
Yeah, I thought wearing his skin husk was an odd call, but seeing his head flapping around on top of yours makes it all worthwhile.
He's done it to me, I'm doing it to him.
Which is to say, just through the sort of the weird scheduling of our current era, Randy is sitting out this podcast, yeah. And Nick and I are running the show.
Yep. So
we'll throw in some jabs at DC for him.
Yeah, of course. I mean, somebody has to.
We won't forget him.
No, we can't forget him. But let's talk about news, because we actually have a lot to burn through.
How can there be, like, news in COVID times?
I don't know, but it still comes out.
I mean, I guess there's still things being made behind the scenes. There's things being finished.
They're starting to film in, like, Europe, where COVID is no longer a thing. So we're going to get stuff from,
what,
like,
could they have possibly done different from us? I thought we did everything perfect.
Yes, we are the most perfect land in all the world. We're just dying.
God. All right.
Let's also, store news. We're open from 11 to 7 every day.
Yep.
Come and get your comics, games, and other enjoyable things.
Yeah, I do. We get emails and stuff occasionally, or calls that are just like, are you guys open? Because, you know, the COVID's spiking again lately, yeah. And there is, you know, concerns that there could be another shutdown. I suspect they won't do it.
Just letting people know, we are still doing curbside, so if you do have those kinds of
concerns,
which we completely understand.
Yeah, we're happy to do that. I think basically we'll do that for, even when COVID's over, if somebody wants to do curbside,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're open 11 to 7, 7 days a week, and barring any particular weirdness, more or less things are on track for us. Wear a mask. Please wear a mask. We require it.
So let's jump into news. And we've got a lot to burn through, so let's start out with a movie that I think Dave and I hold in high esteem, and that is Twister.
Yeah.
Apparently,
Twister, one of the finest B movies ever.
Yes. Apparently, Universal Pictures is looking to reboot the classic tentpole of Twister, which was the first movie I saw at the Lakeline Mall when they had just opened.
Right, I think we discussed this. I went and saw it with my sister, and I don't know if we ruled out that we had seen it at the same time.
Yeah, it's possible. I chose it over Mission Impossible because Twister, damn it.
You know, Mission Impossible, the first one by De Palma, is probably the better movie. If you said, which would I like to watch right now?
I think Twister.
Probably going to be Twister.
Twister, there's just this level of absurdity and fun to it. Mission Impossible has got a lot of pop and fun to it as well.
But it's a little more sophisticated, and yet it's also not quite as smart as it thinks it is sometimes.
Yeah.
But Twister is like a party movie.
Yes.
It's stupid, and it's funny, and it's got like Philip Seymour Hoffman slumming. And it's got people making steaks.
Mm. I'm a little worried about a reboot of this. I mean, so they're looking at director Joseph Kosinski, which I am not 100%. Oh, he's the guy who just directed the Top Gun Maverick.
Okay, so he's kind of like, I'm assuming that movie is going to be a little poppy itself.
Probably. But I think it's going to be serious, though. So yeah. A serious reboot of Twister.
So here's what I think that they should do that. Or that if they're going to do it, that's the way to go. And I'll tell you why, because when Twister first came out, or when I saw it, I was kind of disappointed, because I saw that Michael Crichton was attached to it, and I've read like a zillion Michael Crichton books, and you know, he does like the sort of more serious science, like if you read like Andromeda Strain or Jurassic Park, the book,
yeah.
You'll see all this behind the scenes stuff that's actually all these cool intrigues, and like cool science ideas. He still writes these kind of, with sort of a page-turner pulp style in some ways,
yeah.
But there's like this authenticity to his science, or at least it feels authentic.
Yep.
And when I saw Twister, I was like, oh, this is going to be like for someone who actually has a fascination, and even like my mom grew up with like a fear of storms, and it can conveyed a little bit of that to me, but like also a love of them, and I do love storms as well. But I think that you don't want to go completely serious. That would ruin it. But I think if you go more serious and you have a little bit more science-y stuff going on and a little less absurd.
It's got to be the kids of Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt's characters, right?
You know, I kind of think that could work. You go and make it all continuity. Although, if they're going serious, it should just be its own thing.
Yeah.
Because it kind of won't mix with that backstory.
I'm going to be missing that kind of pop.
When did Twister come out?
It was 90... Ugh, I don't remember.
Five? Later?
96. 96. Is when it hit.
Okay, so it'll be 20 years in 2026?
Yep.
Or no, wait.
No, that'd
no,
be 30
in 2016, yeah. That it was.
It was 20. And 2026 is 30 years.
So they're old enough to have, like, if they had a kid kind of quickly, or twins or something like that, that the kid could be, like, in grad school or something, yeah. Maybe?
Also, though, I'm perfectly fine with a serious look at weather, because I actually think that is kind of would be a neat, and kind of its own niche. Well,
anybody who's ever seen real videos of storm chasers knows that it's crazy, and, like, the effects you could do now, you know, with that kind of, like, realistic camera work of, like, you know, going into storms, they can do some crazy stuff. And did you see this thing about this, like, what they call it, like a mega flash of lightning or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
Or, like, it was called something else, like a fire flash.
It's like Johnny Storm going supernova, essentially. Yeah.
These are, like, the bolts of lightning that they measure. I don't know how they do this. I guess there's equipment. And to qualify as, like, a mega flash or whatever it was, you have to be at least 60 miles long. This streak of lightning, which was somewhere in South America, was over 400 miles long. And the full duration of it, as it, like, arced that across that, was over 10 seconds.
It's insane.
Like, it does feel like because of, like, climate change and stuff, that things are crazier now.
Yeah.
And so I think if they made that kind of the backbone of it, that, you know, wilder weather is happening, that this storm is going to have, like, generate up to, like, 7 mega flashes every hour.
It's got to be better than the recent geostorm, right?
Oh, man, I didn't even see that one.
Don't worry. Don't bother. It was horrible.
I mean, so this movie could go wrong in many ways, and I do think it needs some fun to it.
We'll not have Dusty, though. It's very sad.
Nor Bill, Bill Paxton. Yeah, we won't have Billy the Extreme.
Nope, no the Extreme. Well,
they're gonna have to get like one of like the third rate characters, or like get Cameron, who was in it from Ferris Bueller, and they're gonna be like, they'll be like the wise old mentor will be Cameron.
I like
he's gotta be like all spacey still,
or the guy the Constant.
Yeah, yeah. Or the short chick whose name escapes me.
Yes. Well, moving away from Twister, let's talk about something that I think is beloved to most people that's now getting a comic adaptation from Marvel, and this is Warhammer 40K.
Oh, yeah.
And Marvel somehow snagged the license.
Did you say it's beloved by people?
It is beloved by people.
I mean, it is, but it's kind of a niche thing, though.
I mean,
it's like such a testosterone fest.
Yeah, but like, celebrities play it, and
I mean,
it is maybe a niche, but
yeah,
I think people are very hardcore about it.
They are. Generally, if you're into it, you're kind of into it. Although, I consider myself a casual
and
fan.
I am a casual as well, but I do like it. Yeah. I liked when Boom was doing their comics. They were actually really, really good.
They had some good ones, and then after it, it went to somebody else who wasn't as good. They
had Titan, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And
that's weird,
kinda,
because Titan is a UK company.
Yeah.
They should know what they're doing. Because Warhammer 40K, for people who haven't done it, is like a dark, fascist-y science fiction future that's cribs some stuff from, like, Dune. But it's also, like, it's meant to, like, support the backstory and stuff. This series of miniature games, which is all about combat. Everything is at war, all the different alien species, everybody is at war in this future.
But
and now Marvel's going to do the comic.
Marvel's going to do the comics. It's going to be written by Kieran Gillen, who does Wicked and Divine, and is a Brit himself, and will do probably justice. And art by Jason Burroughs.
Jason Burroughs, who did the Lovecraftian stuff with Alan Moore for
Neonomicon and Crossed, and he did
Was that Avatar Press?
Yeah, it was Avatar. And he also worked on Moon Knight for Marvel.
Yeah, I think he's going to be a good fit for it. You know, Kieran Gillen, I know, is a Warhammer guy. Because I was looking up, I've been listening to it like a Warhammer novel lately, the audio of it, which is quite a good one. It was one of the Horus Heresy ones, which is, you know, for people who follow Warhammer, they know that that's one of the big stories.
So we do know a little bit more about this than I thought.
Oh, yeah?
This is a series that will act as an origin story for Marinus Kalgar, which is the leader of the Ultramarines, showing his beginnings on the world of Novatholium. His campaigns in the Black Crusades, and his dealing with the unfolding mystery of the Black Altar. So this is dealing with, like, definitely canonical stuff.
So, and I don't know that name, but the Ultramarines are, like, the iconic Space Marines in blue.
Yeah.
There's, like, a bunch of different Space Marines, different factions, like the Space Wolves and all these other guys, but the Ultramarines are the iconic ones. I also know that among players, they're kind of considered the boring ones. They're, like, the generic heroes, like, as the Empire is actually kind of a creepy fascisty thing, and as a UK concept, like Judge Dredd, it's like slightly satirical.
Yes,
it's not some people don't always get it, and they think, oh, it's cool that these guys are off killing aliens. But it's like the Starship Troopers thing. It's like a little bit of a litmus test. Like, some people can watch Starship Troopers and be like, this is a movie about kicking alien ass. And some people can watch Starship Troopers and say, this is a movie satirizing, you know, a wartime culture.
Yes.
And Warhammer 40K is just the same. I think Kieran Gillen, who's like, what's he writing right now? Die? Anyway, the point is, he's been thinking about this stuff. I think he is a Warhammer fan who thinks about it a lot. And I think that bodes well for it. Nick, you're right. You liked his work on Die and
stuff.
Yeah,
I like Die. I like Wicked and Divine. I think he's a good writer. I think he'll fit in. It's a little more action-heavy than most of his other stuff, although Die definitely has some of that kind of fantasy element.
There's actually a fair amount, like, you can do more sophisticated stuff with it.
Yeah.
And that's what I've seen in the novels, which is kind of my entry point into it. I don't really play the game, but some people do the video game. Some people do the miniature game. I just read the backstory stuff.
Let's not stray from Marvel. Marvel has also acquired the Alien and Predator franchises for comics.
Are they going to cross over and have, the Tyranids in Warhammer were knockoffs of Aliens originally.
Yes.
Now they can just straight up have a crossover and the Space Marines can fight Xenomorphs.
Well, I mean, historically, those characters have always crossed over with DC characters because, I mean, Predator versus Batman and Superman versus Aliens.
Did Marvel just not want to do it?
I don't know. I don't think they... I don't remember anything.
It must be. They must have thought, like, you know, Dark Horse stands to get more viewers from using Marvel characters than we will from using Dark Horse.
I feel like the X-Men would laugh at the aliens. They're like, we had the Brood, man. They had, like, they were transforming us into them. I mean...
that's true. The Brood were knockoffs of the Xenomorphs.
But, I mean, there's been no other information. We don't know, like, any writers or artists who are getting attributed to this, or...
Poor Dark Horse. They've been pillaged by Marvel.
Yes, but...
Conan, Star Wars, Aliens, and Predator, those were, like, all Dark Horse, right?
Yeah, but Dark Horse is not
what it once was.
No,
Marvel keeps stealing them.
They're still pretty good. They've got, like, the Stranger Things license, they've got Umbrella Academy, they've got,
Probably something from Jeff Lemire.
I'm sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, Black Hammer.
But it used to be, like, kind of... half of their potency kind of came from the fact that they did a good job with licensed stuff. I just sort of feel bad for them.
Yeah, I agree. Next thing up, we're going to move...
By the way, do you think... Are you happy with this? Marvel Aliens and Predator?
I don't know. I feel like I've kind of seen all there is to see with Alien and Predator. I watched that last Predator movie, and I was saddened by it, and I own it, and I'm like, I will never watch this again, probably.
Let me ask this, because I'm kind of in a similar place, and I don't necessarily want more stories in those universes, but they could surprise me.
They could.
Would you be interested in crossovers with Marvel characters?
I could see, a Predator versus Fantastic
Squirrel
Four,
Girl.
Or... I would want it something a little bit off the beaten path. I think we'd get, like, Aliens versus Avengers or something like that. Kind of a planet-wide threat, maybe. But I'd like FF versus Aliens. I think that would be an interesting take on sort of the science side behind.
Although I could also see something like they've descended on New York and taken over. Like, this is like, you know, like a what-if story kind of thing. But it's told from the point of view of Daredevil trying to keep Hell's Kitchen clean. So it's just Daredevil versus something that is way beyond him. Like, I think there's... And then the Punisher just guns them all down. No. I think you could find stuff, but... Yeah, I'm not, like, super excited about these.
Right. Okay, well, let's switch over to some TV news.
Yep.
So we have Fallout TV series from Amazon... And that's from the Westworld creators, which I think Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, if I'm remembering that correctly.
You know, whenever we talk about video game movies, we talk about the fact that they don't really... A-list directors and writers don't do them. I think they don't want to be associated with them. Comics used to be the same way, but, like, I guess sort of since Richard Donner and Tim Burton kind of got the ball rolling, now people see that there's... You know, real stories you can tell with superheroes and stuff like that. And other comic book properties that are completely non-superhero centric. Westworld is pretty big.
Like, Westworld's very big.
That means that it is getting an A-list treatment.
Here's the thing for me, though. I have played Fallout games.
Yep.
I have never completed one. I've really just played it, and then about, like, a couple hours
I am
like, huh, maybe I'm not really into this right now, and that's I've never returned
to
it.
That's how I was with Skyrim, and that's why I guess I'm more of a... Is BioWare, are they... They're the guys who did, like, Mass Effect and stuff, right? Yeah. I kind of liked... They don't do quite so... They give sometimes the illusion of open world, but they're actually much more story-driven and kind of linear. And then you got... who makes these games? Bethesda?
Bethesda, yes.
These guys are the big sandbox world stuff, and the people who love them do love them. So I think this bodes well for them.
I agree.
And Fallout is a well-developed world.
It is. It's post-apocalyptic. There are mutants. You get power armor. You get fun guns. You go on jaunty adventures.
Bottle caps for currency.
Use, like, Nuka-Cola bottle caps for currency.
You'll have Pip-Boys.
Yep. It is definitely ripe for something like this.
Should it be tongue-in-cheek, or like a little bit comedic, or do you go grimdark?
I think you have to have kind of walk the tightrope of both of those things, because if you don't have some of the kind of humorous qualities that, like, of the Nuka-Cola caps and the kind of...
I agree. I think you're right, that they need to look for a balance.
But it can't not have, like, the dark, grimdark kind of... savagery as well, because there definitely was that. I died a lot.
You know, and I think we're going to talk about this a little bit more maybe when we get to a trailer in a minute, but I do wonder if in these scary COVID times, if a post-apocalyptic world is quite as appealing sounding as it would be 5 years ago or a year ago.
Yeah.
But I think neither you nor I will be the big target audience in this. We'll probably try it.
Yeah, well, I'll try it. Amazon is definitely on the verge of pretty much anything they do, I will try.
I'd be interested to hear what people are thinking about this, though. It sounds like a good creative team.
Yep. Speaking of another video game getting a series, it's the Cyberpunk 2020 is getting an anime series to Netflix. Or 2077, not 2020. I went RPG, not... not video game.
So this is the Cyberpunk game that got delayed and hasn't come out yet.
Correct. It's called Cyberpunk Edgerunners. Uh-huh. It's coming... This is coming in a little ways away. It's 2022, apparently. Yeah, but... I don't know. It's a 10-episode spinoff tells the story of a kid in a technology and body modification-obsessed city of the future who becomes an Edgerunner, which is apparently a mercenary...
That sounds like every Cyberpunk story.
It kind of does.
But to be fair... Like, they would on the surface, and I'm sure they will find their voice.
It's developed by CD Projekt Red, so, I mean, I will probably...
Is it Netflix?
Netflix.
Okay.
So, I mean, it'll probably be good.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, things like Castlevania and stuff like that are, like, examples of, like, them kind of doing it right.
I'm maybe not the target audience for this, but I think it's probably going to do quite well.
People are super hyped for the video game.
Yeah.
If the game comes out and is a success, and I suspect it probably will be, it will be, like, is the game, it was supposed to come out late this year.
Was supposed to come out late this year, delayed.
It was until 2021,
and then it got, like, early 2021, and then it got delayed again for later 2021.
Eventually COVID it'll come out in 2077.
Yes. Eventually, when none of us... When we all just have the Fire Channel.
When we're living it, the Fire Channel from Terminator.
Yes.
Kids watching fires inside empty TVs.
Yes.
They couldn't even do that anymore because we have flat screen TVs. The Fire Channel is gone.
You can put the fire behind the flat screen TV, so it becomes like this three-dimensional...
You gotta punch a hole in it.
Yes.
It's a lot of work. But I guess if you do want to watch the Fire Channel, it might be worth it. I like you, it's... What's the show?
Cyberpunk.
Cyberpunk, yeah. I'm not a big cyberpunk guy, I think. But I think the video game may convince me, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, the video game looks amazing. I definitely want to try it. I've heard, like, all the great things about the character creation, and... I'm excited for the game. I will spend the 60, 70 bucks. I don't know what it is. Hopefully I will have it before the Fire Channel exists. moving on, we have something that I think that plays more to Dave's things than mine, which is Margot Robbie and Christina Dodson teaming for a Pirates of the Caribbean movie for Disney.
Is that Margot Robbie and the writer
of Birds of Prey?
Or is it director? Or is it this, is that person this?
No, Birds of Prey writer Christina Hodson. Hodson. We were just watching all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies in the store the other day.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like
there are five of them, by the way. If you've forgotten, you only thought there were three, there are actually two more.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes you could watch just those three and still feel like you've watched five. They're all, they got increasingly bloated.
I think your approach to the Pirates movies is good. You don't watch them all at once. You watch them in sittings, and I think that's better.
Right, yeah, I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, is that I actually had a pretty good time watching, I think, one through four. The fifth one hadn't come out at the time, which, like, they're all, like, 2.5 hours long. But I watched it essentially as a TV show. I'd watch it, and at, like, 30 or 40 minute mark, there would usually be, like, some action scene would have happened, and there'd be kind of a conclusion of some sequence. And I'd be like, okay, that's that episode for that day. I'll watch another episode tomorrow. And it was pretty fun, because then it just became, like, the Adventures of Jack Sparrow TV show.
Yeah.
So this is a rethink of it with, I don't know if that's, like, is Margot Robbie producing, or is she starring?
She's going to star, it seems like. And it's going to be... Not a reboot or anything. This is a completely new project.
But it is still based on the Disney ride concept basics, right?
Yeah, it says it's not intended to be a spinoff of the long-running franchise that had Pirate Jack Sparrow at its center, but rather a wholly original story with new characters under the Pirates moniker.
So here's the thing to me. It's like, there's many ways it could go wrong.
Yep.
Like, or if they just said, like, Margot Robbie is the female Jack Sparrow or whatever.
Yeah.
But I like pirates. And I...
Who doesn't like pirates?
And I think that... and I liked Birds of Prey. And if you took some of that sort of raucous energy, create some new characters and situations, maybe you could use some historicity in there, like the... was it Anne Bonny is the famous female pirate? Or the most famous one? You know, you could either explore that character in sort of the fictional style of those movies, or do something completely original. There was a comic, El Cazador, that came out from CrossGen Comics, like, 15 or 20 years ago. It was a ways back.
Isn't Butch Geis artwork?
No. It was the other guy, Steve Epting.
Was it Steve Epting?
Yeah, Butch Geis did the detective one.
That's right.
Anyway...
They're both great artists.
They are, and they have a somewhat similar style. But El Cazador was about a lady pirate, and was written by Chuck Dixon and drawn by Steve Epting, I think.
It was only one volume. If you can find it, you have found gold.
Yeah, hold on to it.
Because it is good.
But basically, I would like this to be good. It might not be, but I'd like it to be. And I think it has some possibilities.
So the next bit of news is a movie for Netflix. It is the Behind the Mask writer and the writer of Tucker and Dale, or the director of Tucker and Dale, are joining forces for a movie called The Hills Have Eyes for You, which is going to be another horror comedy sort of in the vein of Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
And for those who haven't seen it, the you mentioned the movie Behind the Mask, which is, did you say the writer?
Behind the Mask writer.
Now, I think that movie is not super well known, but it's one I've might have mentioned once or twice here. I'm a fan of it.
The full title is Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon.
Mm-hmm. And it's like a mockumentary in which an aspiring college kind of like RTF major wants to kind of embed with a Jason-style serial killer and learn the tricks of the trade. and it's done comedically.
I have not seen this, but I need to.
It's really good. Like, he's telling him, he's like, you know, it's not easy. He's like, you know, you got to do a lot of cardio. He's like, you can't let him see you running, but you got to move fast, you know? And, like, they take the tropes of the serial killer genre and look at it in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way. But there is this kind of sense of danger, like this sense of like, oh, there, even not quite as much as Scream, but a little bit like, you know how Scream will go from comedy to serious?
Yeah.
Whereas you're like, oh, is it a wise idea to be talking with and hanging out with a guy who's definitely a killer? But there's some fun surprises in that movie, and I ended up really happy with it. It is a good mockumentary. So this and I here's the weird thing. I've seen parts of Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, but I haven't seen all of it. I really liked what I saw. Yeah. So I think this is a good team.
Well, I can heartily recommend Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. It's Alan Tudyk, and I cannot remember the other actor's name. And it's hilarious.
But it's got some good
some horror in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just really, really funny.
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't mind a bit of blood in your comedy.
Right. I think this is like kind of for folks who are like Sam Raimi type fans.
Oh, yeah.
And but also, like, I would say, like Sam Raimi is kind of his own genre, and people probably had, like, Cabin in the Woods would probably also like Tucker and Dale,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think so.
So, The Hills Have Eyes for You, is that what it's called?
It's called The Hills Have Eyes for You.
Okay, so it looks like we're looking at, like, the sort of mutant cannibals.
Yep.
I guess the question will be, like, what their attack will be. Will it be kind of a spoofing it, like, in the style of What We Do in the Shadows? Or is it going to be more like Tucker and Dale, or is it going to be more like Behind the Mask?
I mean, I'm up for it.
All of those things seem like they have possibilities. Incidentally, I've only seen the first Hills Have Eyes movie, which was disturbing, but probably not quite as much as it's kind of rapier 70s incarnation.
But then you watched the new one, right?
Well, that's what I meant.
Oh, okay.
I watched the new one, and I actually find a lot to recommend in
it. Well, that director is the same guy who did Crawl.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just has a unique eye for things.
He does. He actually, and I liked his lesser-known horror movie Mirrors is at least solid with Kiefer Sutherland. So he's kind of at least one person I've kept an eye on. Anyway.
Another movie is apparently about to be in production is a live-action Zatanna film. Warner Brothers is... This is separate from the J.J. Abrams upcoming Justice League Dark HBO Max series. This is a straight-up movie.
DC is kind of all over the place.
They are. I feel like they literally are just throwing darts at a dartboard now.
Yeah, and I'm like, is it even going to really happen? But it sounds like there's... Like, what's the momentum? Does it have a director or anything?
Nothing has been attached.
Do you remember in the 90s, though, when, like, everything was under development and nothing ever happened?
Correct.
Now everything is in development and, like, 20% of them do happen.
So, I mean, do we need a Zatanna movie? I don't know. Can I see a good one being made? Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, to me, she's a character who tends to be in a sort of a more support role in the same way that I think of Hawkeye as being. Like, Hawkeye has had his own comic and there's been some good stuff. But primarily to me, I like Hawkeye when he's in the Avengers in a mix. And I like Zatanna, I think, best like when she's in either Justice League or Batman stories or things like that.
But if you like intertwine with like the other magic users of the DC Universe while doing like flashbacks to her growing up on the road with Zatara.
Yeah.
Doing like major shows.
Yeah.
And sort of.
I kind of also I want the DC Universe setting.
Yeah.
But it's... And I don't want, like, really, I want not just the magic verse. Like, I want it to still be the world where there's also Apocalypse and other stuff. I don't know if we're going to get that.
We could have her father teaming up with the Wizard Shazam.
I think that'd
Jimin
be cool.
Jimin Hansu version from the...
That'd be all right. And they could bring it, like, so other people, like, Constantine is the obvious one because at least since the 80s, they've made her his ex.
Yeah.
Or him, her ex, whatever you want to think about it. I was talking about this, we were talking about this with our coworker Anna, and she was saying that, like, Deadman would be cool.
It would be.
Like, any of those characters that are kind of fringe magic users would be fun in a movie like this.
And I think you could do a story wholeheartedly about Zatanna and just have those kind of peppered in as kind of cameos or Easter eggs or something to show him. And they can spin off into the Justice League Dark movie.
You know how Ant-Man has his crew?
Yeah.
They could be kind of like that, where they're like, they're fun and memorable characters, but you keep the focus on her. I think part of the story you tell with Zatanna is like kind of about like the price of magic, which I think is sometimes the backstory of her dad.
Yeah.
Like, he kind of got into this real magic and it got dangerous. And then she also kind of walks that line between stage magician stuff and real magic. Here's a question. When she does her backward spells, do you throw up subtitles so people know what she's saying?
Oh, that would be kind of cool. And do it in sort of a like unique font.
Like it could actually appear backwards at first and do that kind of thing where it like ripples and you see what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I think you don't do it as like actual subtitles, but like her, like, that's the magic incantation kind of. fun kind of have fun with it.
Yeah. I can see definite ways this could work. She doesn't have like obvious like villains, I think, right? Like
no,
any
but
magic
you could throw her up against like
Baron Brimstone
or Clarion or
yeah. Clarion would make a fun on-screen bad guy. They need some more good villains.
Who's the stupid wizard from DC they always use?
Mordru or no?
No, he's lower tier than Mordru. let's stay away from Mordru.
we'll avoid the time travel stuff
yes.
for now.
Crap, I can't remember.
I'm afraid I don't know this person.
You could give her some good villains.
One of my favorite DC stories is almost a non-story story, the original Books of Magic miniseries that Neil Gaiman did, which is literally taking the kid who some people think Harry Potter was a ripoff of. It was like a year or two before, but looks a lot like him, who is destined to become, they say, the greatest magic user since Merlin. And, basically, you know, like John Constantine.
Tim Hunter?
Zatanna, yep. And the Phantom Stranger and other DC characters take him on sort of a tour of the worlds of magic, especially the DC worlds of magic, to see if he wants to do it or not, because it's also putting your soul at risk, basically. Yep. And so you get to see all these kind of, the Neil Gaiman sort of sophisticated version of a lot of kind of weird stuff, like House of Mystery and all this other stuff.
Mr. E
is a super creepy dude.
Yes. I always remember the dead man appearance and Constantine walking around. The idea of walking around with Constantine just sounds fun, even though you're probably going to die.
it's why, though, I feel like the DC, like I want it set in that universe, because that showed how fun it can be.
Right.
And like and scary, too.
They should just do a Books of Magic series and just call that a... Buy that from Neil Gaiman and be just do that as your kind of over-encompassing all things magic for the DC universe.
I mean, it's not a crazy idea. Although the thing is, of course, Tim Hunter does look exactly like Harry Potter. They'd have to change up what his deal is if they did it. Or they could take him out of it and have it be called Books of Magic, but about, like, all the people who populate those worlds, which maybe is what you meant.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, throw Tim Hunter in there, fine. Or
he dies in the first episode.
A gender-flipped version of a...
For
of
sure.
them or whatever. Okay, so we're going to now talk about a couple of trailers, which we have Gerald Butler or Gerard Butler's kind of post-apocalypse kind of style.
It's a disaster. It's like an apocalypse disaster movie. Like end. What do they call that one? Like 2012.
It was 2012, right?
It was way back in the Mayan apocalypse.
Yes.
We're in the new apocalypse. Yeah. Actually, I know that there was a meme or whatever going around that like their calendars were off and 2020 was the actual date.
Well, damn it, Nostradamus. Or in the Mayan.
What's the one where the world freezes and stuff, though?
That Day After Tomorrow.
Day After Tomorrow.
Yes.
Anyway, it's kind of one of
it's
those with some Armageddon thrown in. And
this looks like a... the world is ending by meteors or asteroids, a world-ending event.
Right. Like, there's small ones that are, like... I mean, actually, just not unlike Armageddon, there's small storms.
Yep.
But also, like, Florida gets essentially, like, wiped off the map by it early on.
But where Armageddon handled the death in kind of a fun pop way...
Yeah.
This one looks like... depressing...
Well, what was the other one that came out around Armageddon time? Where they had to, like...
Oh, Deep Impact.
Deep
that was
Impact.
The Morgan Freeman...
That was the serious one of its
time. That was
the
serious one of its
and
time.
And I don't really remember it. I don't think I've ever seen it all the way through.
It was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely preferred the Michael Bay kind of schlockfest.
Right. I think... Well, here's what my thought was when I was watching this. I like kind of disaster movies and end times movies.
Yeah.
It's a harder to like them... when you're living through a pandemic.
Yeah.
It's a little scarier when you've been quarantined, you know, and all of that stuff. There's still, like, adventure and dodging meteors that are exploding on the highway. And I was like, this should be at least somewhat fun to me. And I'm like, this is creepy to
but
me.
But it also looks like we see Gerard Butler fighting with other people on the road. Like, they're scavenging to survive.
What's it called,
like,
by the way? This movie's
Greenland.
Called... Greenland. And it's called that because there's, like, what's supposed to be, like, some mega shelter or something there,
Greenland.
And everybody is maybe trying to get there. Or maybe most people don't know about it. And
somehow he comes across the information.
He's either ex-military defending the president or ex-military getting his family to a shelter.
But it's him and his family trying to get to the bunker in Greenland, which... seems more like a Netflix movie. I don't know if I'm going to venture out to see this one. I don't know if I'm going to venture out to a movie theater in general.
Yeah, well, but I mean,
I would rather see Tenet if I'm gonna go.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's a fun thing. It's like, assuming you're gonna go out to the movie theater, get COVID and die. What movie are you gonna do it for?
I would do it for Black Widow, actually, not Tenet.
I don't know that. I wouldn't do it for either of those right now.
No, you have to. You have to choose a movie.
I don't know. There probably is a movie that's coming up, but I can't think of what my
movie is. What about that David Patel?
I'm going to go see Twister 2.
Is it David Patel who's doing that kind of weird fantasy for A24 films? Green Knight?
Right, right. It's a retelling of the story that was... I feel like J.R.R. Tolkien or somebody like that wrote that original story in the 20s.
Or Dev Patel. No.
But it got kind of, folded in. I'm not going to die for the horror version of a Arthurian story. I want to see it, not quite ready to die for it.
Yes. And the last trailer we have is more to my heart, which is Netflix is doing a Transformers War for Cybertron anime that's hitting July 30th. Which is not too far away.
Why do they call it an anime, but it's CG and...
It's CG.
Does that mean it has anime directors?
It probably so.
Or has anime become their generic word for anything they animate?
It might be. I don't know.
Steven Universe, the famous anime. I guess that's not Netflix.
It's Netflix. They do what they want.
Yeah. But sure.
And this one, I don't know. It looks solid.
Yeah, it's set on Cybertron in the old war days, and you said
it's in the very end of the war, where the Autobots are
they're on the ropes,
they're knocked on their backs, and it looks like they're trying to get off of Cybertron.
There's a kind of a cool dusty aesthetic to it, you know, that looks like a world that's been at war long enough so that they aren't gleaming Transformers. They all seem to have a little bit of wear, either if not wear and tear, at least there's filters and stuff that kind of make them all look a little.
Well, it looks like the CG designs are what they used for the current figures.
Yeah, you were telling me.
And
that.
The designs all have kind of a scuffed up, kind of dirty nature to them. They all have cracks in their arms and legs and hides and everything.
So they're definitely running with it.
Yeah, they're definitely running that they have been fighting for a while. And
oh, yeah, that's right. I made a joke about Optimus Prime having cracks in his tits.
Yes, cracks in his tits.
His windows.
Yes, his front windshields.
Windows, as not very polite Decepticons call them sometimes, have cracks in them.
Yes, they do. The voice cast is not as good. It's weird to hear Optimus Prime
Cullen or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
and not hear Peter Cullen, but...
It's close enough.
It's close.
Basically, if I'm not quite looking for a new Transformers thing. If people told me, though, that the episodes were good or then I might be interested. You know, the comic that launched a year or two back was it was kind of weirdly sophisticated.
Yes.
The super political to the point of kind of boring... But there was a murder mystery and stuff.
But there
going
was
on.
No transforming.
There was minimal transforming.
This one I heard the sound effect several times. Yes.
Yeah. But if they took a bit of that from the comic, if they kind of wanted a bit of sophistication, I'd be down for it. I know as a cartoon, they're gonna keep the action.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will. You must be the canary in the coal mine, Nick. Tell me if it's good enough that I should transform into a watcher or transform into an ignorer.
Well, I think that does it for news. We'll be back in just a second and talk about comics from this week and last week. All right, so let's talk about comics from this week.
Okay. Last week was really small. We're going to mention that too. This week is getting back up there again. We've got I think it was 55 books when I counted. I've been kind of paying attention to the numbers lately. I don't know how many we used to more regularly get, but I would say it was 80 to 90 in a given week sometimes. And so we're still not at our big numbers, but and it kind of rises and falls. But I've seen as high as I feel like we were up to 70 or 75 a week or two ago.
Last week was really small. It was mainly all indie books.
Right. For whatever reason, Marvel and DC kind of both did a skip week that it was sort of, COVID catch-up related stuff.
This week, however, Marvel and DC are back with the Avengeance, releasing some pretty big titles, actually.
Yeah, let's just go through some of the notables.
I think one of the biggest ones that I think both Dave and I were excited for was Deceased Dead Planet.
Is the formal sequel to Deceased.
Correct.
DC's kind of zombie-ish story, but it's actually a pretty cool anti-life equation created zombie.
Yeah.
But it has had a few one-shots, and a couple one-shots and a mini-series about villains.
Yeah, then that was called Deceased Unkillables.
But this is the original creative team. Tom Taylor and...
Trevor Harrison,
returning with a direct sequel. I guess... I don't want to spoil necessarily how it ends. Do we have to spoil it to talk about it?
But it does definitely take up right where it ends.
Right.
Well, set really, a few years past the ending of it.
Basically, people know some very bad things happened.
Yep.
And what we see is what has become of our survivors, 5 years later?
Yep.
And we also find out that a few things that we thought happened weren't quite what we thought happened.
Right. There's definitely some... it's Tom Taylor. So Tom Taylor has a knack for writing these characters.
Yeah, want to put them in a room and just let them go.
Yeah, there's...
You know what I love, Nick? I was thinking about Bendis earlier and how he kind of frustrates me with... He can write a good scene, but there's that sameness to his characters.
Yeah.
But I feel like all the characters come through in this one. You want to just say a few of who the surviving heroes are?
Yeah, I mean, the Dino Lance or Black Canary and Green Arrow is still involved here.
But Black Canary is different. What is her difference?
She is different because it happened in the last one.
Uh-huh.
She has Green Lantern's ring.
Yeah, she is now essentially the Green Lantern.
And the Green Lantern's chorus play a big part in this because they are kind of still around.
Right. They sort of have... I think we can kind of say this part. They've kind of cordoned off Earth. They play the zombie plague ridden Earth, which was I thought a pretty cool idea.
I want to harken back to what Dave said in the last segment, is that some of the world ending post apocalyptic books are really hard to read, as they are to watch as well. Mm-hmm. Somehow Tom Taylor kind of takes the edge out.
He does. Like, some bad things happen to characters you love.
Yes.
In this, but he doesn't grind your face into it.
Right. There is all this death and destruction stuff happening, but it's still really well told.
Well, do you remember, when Tom Taylor first got on our radar, it was because he was doing a surprisingly great comic based on the DC fighting game Injustice.
Yeah.
Which is all about this also kind of apocalyptic world where Superman becomes a fascist after, Lois... With
gets
his
killed
while she's pregnant, he caused it, and and he kills the Joker. It's so dark that I was I don't want to touch this. And then he had some of the best stories scenes I've seen with Green Arrow and Harley Quinn and Batman and Superman, for that matter. There's a sweet scene, I don't know if you've read this, where Superman asks Batman to be the godfather of his son.
I have not read this. I did not read much of Injustice.
So he flies up, and Batman kind of does his detective thing, and he's like, there's something wrong with you. He's like, there's a catch in your voice, and you're a guy who doesn't get unnerved easily. He's like, I know you, I can't remember quite why, but he detectives out. He's like, Lois is pregnant, isn't she? Superman is like, but I've got a surprise for you. Or he's like, I want you to be the godfather to my son. And Batman kind of has this moment of he's like, what? And he's like, I got you on that one. He surprised him. And there's some really beautiful, sweet scenes in there.
Yeah.
And so this kind of has some of that going on. There's, I think, the Super Sons get some good scenes, and they got some great scenes in the previous one, and they get some good scenes in this one.
Yeah.
And you get to sort of see them growing up. So it's, Jonathan Kent and Damian.
Yep. There's a special moment that I will not reveal that made me kind of cheer with joy, because it is awesome.
I'm wondering what scene it is you're talking about.
While
you're looking that up to show to me and not the viewers or our listeners, I will say that Trevor Harrison's art on this, that scene was great.
Yeah.
That scene was so good. Trevor Harrison's doing this great art on it that has the... Nick, is it still kind of colored with that sort of... Almost the same way that Transformers thing we talked about has that sort of dusty palette?
Yep.
I feel like this has a sort of dusty palette, but the heroes still look like heroes, right?
Yeah.
Trevor Harrison can draw DC's heroes.
Yes. And there's some splash pages that I'm like, oh, that's really awesome. But he also does these smaller kind of two people talking moments yep. with just as much panache.
Yep. So that's off to a good start. I should say, like, I just a few weeks ago read Deceased. I was late to the thing.
Yeah.
But I bought the hardcover, which has all the... which is a beautiful production. It includes one or two of the one-shots. They've just been integrated into it. And it has all the cover variants at the end that were all their homages to horror covers. So if anybody kind of... And I sort of would recommend reading it before this one. It's not going to be the end of the world, so to speak, if you do. If you don't. But I would kind of recommend it. And I think I bumped our minimums up on that. So the Deceased hardcover of the original series, it's a really good read. Good buy. It's like probably $25 or something.
Yeah. Other things that came out this week, I want to mention the second issue, finally, of Strange Academy, which is sort of the Harry Potter world of the Marvel Universe. We get to see the,
it's like a Sorcerer Academy?
Yeah, it's run by, like, Doctor Strange and, Doctor Voodoo and, Magic and Scarlet Witch and,
yep.
Basically we get to see the kids sort of go through a day. Going through different classes.
I always kind of like those stories.
Yeah.
The day in the life of.
They get taught about like the history of mystical objects by the Ancient One. How the Ancient One is there, I don't know. But then there are classes done by Man-Thing and the Magic and Damon Hellstrom, which is pretty awesome. I just like the feel of this book. It's
Damon
light.
Hellstrom should not be allowed to teach in there.
I mean, same thing as Magic shouldn't teach children. I mean, she's insane.
Yeah, and she's also been possessed by, like, demons and stuff,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, she was, like,
but
the
Damon
literal
Hellstrom
lord
is,
of limbo.
But Damon Hellstrom is the literal son of Satan.
That's true. Now, I mean, Satana is not in here, so...
All right, well...
They draw a line somewhere.
All right.
But it's Scotty Young... He's got kind of a funness to his writing, and Humberto Ramos's artwork is just fun. It really is. It's just evokes this kind of fun and unique quality to it. And I just love this book.
It sounds like a little bit like Gotham Academy never quite became the series I wanted it to, but it had its moments. And I kind of like these Harry Potter the idea of these Harry Potter knockoffs, which is to say boarding school adventures, basically. You know, when I was a kid, the New Mutants were basically sort of a version of that.
Yeah.
That was the first time they really leaned into the school side of sort of Xavier's Academy. So, yeah, I kind of like, I dig a series like that.
What about you, Dave? What was this week?
So, this week wasn't, I haven't had like not a huge one for me, but I definitely wanted to mention in addition to, I mean, the big one for me was Deceased. What's the subtitle?
Dead Planet.
Dead Planet. But I also wanted to mention that continuing to enjoy the Empire crossover from Marvel, and this week this is maybe the final prelude to it.
Yeah,
this is called Fantastic Four Empire, and the Fantastic Four. This Empire, of course, is their story about their Marvel's big summer event about the unification of the Skrull and Kree space empires. They've been fighting since the 1970s of Marvel time. And have always been at each other's throats, and now, for various reasons, they are unifying. And I've loved the two previous preludes to this, and this one, the FF have had a long history, especially with the Skrulls. The Skrulls were introduced in the Fantastic Four, and so it makes sense that they would be in here. And here we have the FF like on a sci-fi, like on a space mission. And kind of needing to, a little bit like in, remember in Phantom Menace, they like were trying to get Queen Amidala back, but they like had to stop for repairs?
Yeah.
Sort of like that. They have a thing going on, and they have to stop for repairs, and they end up on a planet where there's sort of stuff going on with a new, what do you call them, Elder of the Universe?
Yep.
New Elder of the Universe. It involves the Kree and the Skrull, and they begin, they're having to do some guesswork as to what's going on. But they kind of start to infer that big galactic happenings are going on. There's a reason. The, like, whole galactic economy is changing. And I don't want to give away any of the details.
I thought that kind of nuances were really interesting. Kind of the back stuff. Like, oh, if the currency goes bankrupt, what does that mean for the rest of the world? Like, other worlds involved?
Basically, what does this unification mean for the entire, like, cosmic universe? And it's all lensed through the eyes of, like, an adventure that they have on this planet. But there's definitely like, it's kind of a neat way to see it. It's sort of a, I actually continue to like their build-up to this. I actually don't know quite what the main story is going to be like, but all the build-up has been cool. They've kind of made me care about this this war that I've never had particular stakes in, but they've made it cool. Do we want to talk about a few from last week?
Yeah, I only have one to mention from last week.
Yep.
And I think we're going to be...
Both of our books are Kirkman.
I was going to say, most of them, we're going to be talking about Robert Kirkman books. I'm going to be talking about Firepower, specifically the Firepower trade, which is called Volume 1 Prelude.
It came out the same week as the first issue of a series that the trade is a prequel to.
Correct. This is the Kirkman that I like. It's not super violent...
doesn't have the nihilism of Walking
Dead. Right, it doesn't have the nihilism of Walking Dead. It's got more of, like, the family vibe that Invincible did before...
The first trade.
Yeah, like. Before we started getting people punching through their stomachs and chests and yes. head bursting. But Firepower is sort of a martial arts looking at a kind of a sect of people who, in the Himalayas, that have this kind of control over fire. And okay. it's about martial arts masters.
That's a sort of elemental control that we kind of know from, like, video games, yeah. like the Hadouken.
And the main guy who runs it is very much a Pai Mei kind of think Kill yeah. Bill. I really do think Kirkman watched Kill Bill and was like, oh, I could, this
I'm gonna run with that.
I want to run with that.
Is it set in contemporary times, or is it the past?
It's sort of in the past. It's about a main character.
I guess that is the prequel graphic novel.
Yeah. It's about a guy named Owen Johnson. He's an Asian American who was basically adopted by Americans,
yep.
and he's basically wanting to find out about his past, his actual parents.
Does he have some lineage that yeah. ties him to the...
Yeah, and he journeys to China to learn about his birth parents, leads him to a Shaolin temple, and it's really cool because the world building is really great. You get to meet all the people who live there, sort of learn about training. It's
is
sort
it
of
like, is it like when Bat? Let me just throw a couple of training things. There's like Batman training with Ra's al Ghul. There's the Pai Mei training, and then there's like kind of like training in like I don't know Avatar: The Last Airbender. And I know this has some elemental elements. Is there any one of those that it's closest to?
It's sort of like the Kill Bill. The one thing I will say is he doesn't travel to specifically learn how to fight. He is literally...
Oh, it's his past.
He wants to know about his past. And sort of the training and learning is kind of an afterthought. Because...
actually makes me more interested in it. That it's not just a traditional go and learn from the
Yeah,
master.
The main guy who is running sort of their Pai Mei, mm-hmm. he knows about his father, but it's his parents. But he doesn't, like, outright tell them that. It's just an interesting sort of unwinding mystery okay. that leads to some interesting places.
Does it feel like it has an obvious destination?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
And I will also say one of the biggest things about it is the art. Robert Kirkman always teams up with somebody really good.
Yep.
This one is Chris Samnee, who is an amazing artist.
If anybody doesn't know Chris Samnee's art, I mean, he had a pretty strong run on Daredevil, notably recently yeah. with Mark Waid. But look up his name online and look at his sketches. Like, when he does a sketch for people, sometimes a lot of times there's background to it, and his, like... his control of, like, composition is Damn. Stunning. He does the coolest backgrounds. And it's, like, it's got this almost noir look to it at yep. times. So, yeah.
I will say, you know, if you love, like, Mortal Iron Fist, the Brubaker infraction mm-hmm. that they did, if you're just a fan of martial arts films, mm-hmm. Bruce Lee or whatever, give Firepower a shot. It's a $10 trade. I think it's really worth the investment.
The other day I picked up that 80th anniversary of Green Lantern, and it was $10, and it wasn't a trade paperback. Now, I feel like I got my money's worth. Yeah. It was good, but $10 is a good price for a trade.
Dave, what is the other Kirkman book?
The other Kirkman book is Nihilistic Zombies. Yeah. This was a kind of a neat thing. This is called this is a Walking Dead special, the first Walking Dead story that Kirkman's done since ending the series, surprisingly, about like a year ago, I think.
Yeah.
And... it's kind of was like he kind of did this for comic shops in a way, even though it was a story he wanted to tell, too.
Yeah, this was kind of sprung on us. We didn't know anything about it.
We had not ordered this, but 2 or 3 weeks ago, we just found out it was coming. It was, I think, based on whatever we had ordered of what the last issue of Walking Dead was. And he kind of sprung that on us as a comic shop exclusive. So yep. brought in a lot of people looking to check it out. And although I have not followed Walking Dead in a zillion years, I was like, I'm going to give it a read. I enjoyed it. This is his, it's called Negan Lives. Negan, of course, being the bat-wielding villain who is one of their nastiest bad guys. Yep. He killed a main character in a really horrible way. But and here's the interesting thing. I recommend reading the backup page to it where he does his, like, many letters and stuff. Because apparently he originally intended for Negan to get killed in the final issue. And the artist, Charlie Adler, like, sent him a message that he was working on the script and started drawing it. And he was just... this is kind of interesting. He regretted that they were killing him off. He said it was kind of a very Western filmmaking kind of style of approach where, you know, like, the hero takes down the villain and...
Yeah.
And he felt that there was a more interesting story to tell with him if he were to live. And he said he wasn't actually agitating for it. He was just saying, but he's like, I'm starting script working on it. And he's like, I was just like, oh, that's too bad. But Kirkman took it to heart and rewrote the last six pages so that Negan did not die. And ended up with this rather interesting story about what happens to somewhat irredeemable monster.
Yeah.
When he kind of runs up against people who are, I'm not going to say worse than him, but it's more like they messed with the wrong guy. These are kind of like some raiders. But he ends up, there's like a girl that's working with him that he does sort of forge a connection with. And I don't know if like this is ultimately a sort of path to redemption thing or what. But it was an interesting one-shot with some fascinating character stuff in it. And a pretty memorable ending. So, I just noticed it actually has a few preview pages of
Firepower.
Of Firepower, yeah. So, if chances are you probably already know about Negan Lives if you were interested in it, but if you weren't, or if you don't know about it, or you just want to pick up that kind of a historical one-shot, we've still got some copies left on the shelf, and I recommend it.
All right, well, that should do us with comics. Let's talk about some things we've been watching.
Yeah.
I'm going to start us out with something Dave and I both watched a little bit of. I think I've watched more than he has because I just had it on at the store, but he was engrossed in The Floor is Lava.
Which is, at first I thought you were going to talk about the thing that's on Disney Plus that everybody is talking about right now.
We're going to get that at the very end.
Okay. Yes, The Floor is Lava is a much more pop and very entertaining game show.
Game show that Netflix put up a couple weeks ago. I saw some promos for it and I'm like, this looks so stupid. But I'll watch it anyways. And it was not stupid. It was, in fact, delightful.
I feel it's the kind of stupid we need right now.
Yes.
Nick, let me quick ask you. The teams in it, they seem to be sometimes family, sometimes friends, sometimes co-workers.
Yep.
It could be any sort of group of, like, what, three people?
Yeah, it's always three people. It varies. There's no, like, major athletes or anything. There are a few that are, like...
Sometimes they're from, like, a gymnastics team or whatever.
Correct. But then there's a team of flight attendants.
Yes.
And three best friends who still live at home and trying to get out. Because you basically are fighting your way through this puzzle box.
It is an actual room.
It's like an escape room.
As a singular room with, like, a theme to it, though.
Yes. Like, the first one is, like, a basement where you're trying to get across... there's also a one that's a kitchen, and there's
a sci-fi one that had like planets of the solar system and stuff like that,
and rockets.
But imagine, if you will, that just like kids trying to cross a room on chairs and tables and stuff like that. It's those kind of things. It's just that they actually went and actually have lava, sort of.
Yes, it is this roiling water that's orange. And
there's like lights and stuff, so that it looks kind of like lava.
It does, and it spews up and everything. If any part of your body like goes into the water at all, you are dead.
Yeah,
and you die in the biggest fashion.
The way they always
edit
these together is so that you like fall down, and then the people kind of always go dramatically screaming, usually while their friends in kind of mock anxiety are like, no.
Yes, think Darth Vader. No.
Yes.
But it's stupid and fun. And
they all have to cross from one side of the room basically to another, but it's not easy. There's like, you have to go these awkward, weird routes.
Yeah.
You might have to go hand over hand on, like, monkey bar type things, or make a big leap where you're going to land hard and knock the wind out of yourself. And I squint. I squirm a little bit watching some of this, because I'm like, if they land wrong on that chair they're jumping onto, it's gonna hurt.
Yeah, Kaylee couldn't watch it. It was too kind of tense for her. She was like, I don't like this. So
I had a little bit of that, but it was the fun, and there's like a fun narrator.
Yeah, the narrator's throwing up puns galore, and they're bad puns, and they're fun. But it's also just, it was a good way to waste some time. It's just kind of popcorn entertainment.
I would say this is one of those weird ones where I would say, even if you don't think you'll like it, like, I don't watch game shows, but like, I'm like, take a peek. It's fun, and it is a kind of a, like, you're gonna at least enjoy, I think, one episode worth of it, and you might be like, that's all I need to see.
Yep.
But catch at least one.
We have a couple other Netflix shows to talk about.
Yep.
But Dave, why don't you tell me about She-Ra?
You have to say She-Ra.
She-Ra.
You can't say She-Ra. I can say that back in the He-Man days, when I was watching He-Man as a kid, I didn't have particular interest in She-Ra because I deemed it too girly for me at the time. Because
we were idiots.
I was a dumb 80s kid, and I felt like I was not allowed to watch this. But secretly, I was like, Hordak, I thought, looked very cool.
Hordak is a cool character design.
And She-Ra herself looked cool, and I was like, I kind of want to watch this She-Ra.
Didn't she have a flying horse, too? Or?
She did. The flying horse is a sarcastic horse in this current one.
That's awesome.
So this is a rethink of it, and I want to say, you know, it has something of the kind of style that people might recognize from, like, that Steven Universe look and stuff. Where it's an action adventure cartoon, the new one from Joel Jones? No.
Noel Stevenson. Yes.
I'm mixing up names that have that OL sound to them. Who did what's the
Lumberjanes?
Yeah, among others, lots of other comics, but that's the big one. And it's kind of, I think, known for, like, super LGBT-friendly, queer-inclusive kind of events. And that's half the reason I decided to check this out, because I was told by someone that this is the gayest cartoon of all time. And I was like, let's see.
What is that?
So this follows She-Ra, who is, in fact, in her civilian identity before she swords up like He-Man. Just like him, has a civilian identity as Princess Adora, and they all have these ridiculous names, which, by the way, were... I don't know if you know this, Nick, but JMS, J. Michael Straczynski, creator of Babylon 5 and a zillion comics, he was one of the main guys who worked on the original She-Ra.
Oh, interesting. And he
got his start, like, writing for Masters of the Universe, so that was one of his things back then. But this new one is a, like, kind of a little more pop one. It has a lot more humor to it, but there's a little bit of some seriousness to it too. So Adora is working for the Horde, and doesn't know that they're the bad guys in the first episode.
Okay.
They do live in a place called the Fright Zone. You know, when you're raised in it, you don't know it's not the norm. You just think the Fright Zone is everyday stuff. She's working alongside, like, another agent for Hordak, called Catra, who's like a cat type person. And they will end up becoming key characters, because over the course of the first episode, on a mission, basically, Adora first of all finds that sword and that she may be destined to become She-Ra, but they've clearly thought up, there's like a detailed backstory, and there's like sort of the ancient ones of this world and their ancient technology all over the world, and the sword is part of that, and there have been other She-Ra incarnations in the past, and she is just the latest one, and there's also like new technology to find and stuff, but she meets up with essentially this group that's sort of like essentially the rebels, the rebellion, which are a sort of a league of not particularly very well-aligned princesses, each with their own kingdoms, and that whole first season is about attempts that both fail and sometimes succeed to try and unite the princesses against them. But in the meantime, she becomes friends with Glimmer and Bo, the two sort of two other young heroes who from this one particular kingdom, who will end up becoming her best friends and the core characters.
Yeah.
But Catra, her friend, and there's no kind of looking past it, a sort of a what would have, I think, been a romantic interest to her. She feels betrayed by She-Ra leaving her behind and becomes a sort of nasty villain. But she's kind of a likable nasty villain.
Yeah.
And you sort of feel for her a little bit. And there's along the way, there's other fun characters like, was it Seahawk? They're going to visit this one princess like who's got like a high seas thing. And along the way, they meet this kind of like sailor for hire guy who's kind of like Aquaman on The Brave and the Bold. He's ridiculous. He's like, Seahawk is here.
That's awesome.
And always he's like singing sea chanties and stuff like that. And he has an on-again, off-again relationship with the princess that they're going to go see, who's very much this, like, oh, good, visitors kind of person. Anyway, the show has clever writing, likable characters, great designs. It is very LGBT-friendly, but I don't even want to, like, discuss, like, whether it's in your face or not about it. This is not, like, a romance show, so there's not a whole lot of that going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe subsequent seasons will get into it a little bit more. But I would say it is absolutely queer-friendly and inclusive in cool ways.
I remember the animation style being really cool.
Yeah, like, I think it's got a great look. I actually have enjoyed I kind of blasted through the first season just to see what it was like. I was liking it enough to obviously continue with it. And, here's an example of a little bit of its queer friendliness. There's an episode where this one princess, who's like a... She actually reminded me of Toph from...
Avatar.
But she's like a princess of the Northlands, and she's very young. She looks like she's like 12 or something like that. And she kind of... She is not going to be easy to get an alliance with. She's kind of grumpy and stuff like that. But she's having a ball that's a princess ball that's hosted every year. And, Catra shows up. And during one of the notable scenes, there's, like, during the ball dancing, there's intrigues going on, and she ends up dancing with She-Ra. And while they're dancing, they're kind of arguing with each other. There's clearly sort of a weird love-hate going on with them that continues throughout the series. And it's one of those dances where you pass off different partners around.
Yeah.
So she ends up talking to some of her friends, and they're like, hey, somebody's infiltrating this. We just found out about it. And then she goes back to Catra, and she's having, like... she's like, I know what you're doing, and she's kind of on to her now, but she's also dancing with her.
Yeah.
And, like, it's both cute and kind of cool, and that's sort of the tone of the series. I'm not gonna say it's for everybody, I don't feel it's as sophisticated as Last Airbender, but it is a good show, and I do recommend it.
On levels like Voltron, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say it's closer to that. I actually think Voltron might be a little bit better overall, okay. But I didn't finish watching Voltron.
And I know there are, like, four... Maybe even five seasons of She-Ra out right now?
I think so, yeah. And I think it's still going, but they may be on the last season.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a show where I'm like, there's enough backstory and stuff going on that I kind of want to see how it ends, so I'll probably continue watching it at some point.
Yeah.
What have you been watching,
Mike? I have weirdly been watching another Netflix show entitled The Babysitter's Club.
I've heard of The Babysitter's Club.
Yeah, they've been around forever. I never read any of the books. My wife, however, loved them all, and apparently there's like a side series that she read as well.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
However...
They've also been in comic form. They've been adapted by... Raina Telgmeier, who is the Stephen King of, like, YA graphic novels, and so they've gotten sort of a new lifespan through those.
Yeah, but this is... I was kind of like, okay, we'll watch it. I'm probably not going to enjoy but I'll at least give it an episode. It is kind of the comfort...
That's our theme here. Things we didn't think we were going to enjoy, but enjoyed.
Yes. It is a comfort TV show that I did not know I wanted.
Okay.
Because it's...
That stuff is important in COVID times.
It's wholesome. It provides really good messages as these kids sort of band together to form a group that does babysitting, but you get to...
Is it like a babysitting syndicate?
Yes, it is a babysitting syndicate. However, I really like the fact that each episode is told from a different kid's perspective.
They jump around to the different...
And some of the adults that show up are people you're going to recognize. Alicia Silverstone from Clueless shows up as one of the main kids' mothers, and she's amazing. Mark Feuerstein, who, if you watched Royal Pains, and he's shown up in various other places. Mark Evan Jackson, who was on The Good Place and is on Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Mm-hmm.
He shows up as one of their fathers. It's a really good cast, and just... A really fun 10-episode series that they're obviously going to do more. It's doing really, really well.
Mm-hmm. So an hour or half hour?
Half hour shows. And there's not really...
Drama comedy?
It is a drama comedy because they're definitely not shying away from current political topics.
Oh, interesting.
So it's definitely kind of utilizing that to kind of jab here and there. And I was kind of surprised at the level that it goes to at times.
That's
I was like, this is really cool. But it also deals with, like, like one of the main character's father kind of just left.
Okay.
So she's dealing with that, and another one's dealing with a pre-existing condition. She's like diabetic, like a childhood diabetes, and dealing with like her parents' sort of not shame per se, but they're not really like wanting that to be out in the open. They're trying to protect their kid, but she sees it as something else.
Yeah.
So there's kind of dealing with topics that I think should resonate with kids and parents alike. And I just think it was really well done.
Interesting. That sounds good. We can maybe use some wholesomeness like that going on.
I think everyone...
Is the writing pretty clever?
The writing is very clever. The characters are all good. I couldn't really find a flaw.
Interesting.
Which I was kind of surprised by, but like
all
I said...
All the swearing.
Yes, all the swearing in their crime babysitting syndicate.
The babysitting syndicate. They got to lean on the other syndicates when they try and move in on them.
All right. So here's the big one. So I did not have the $2,000 to see this in its original run of on Broadway or off Broadway or wherever it was.
Yeah.
So I was pretty jazzed when Disney Plus announced that they were getting Hamilton.
I remember it was coming to Austin, like, in the last year or two.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, like, if you go in early, you can get tickets for good prices. And I was like, let's see what a good price is. And it was, like, $800
yeah.
or something.
I definitely did that whole lottery thing where every day you kind of put, you put in and you... They selected two people to get tickets,
man.
And I was like, there's no way I'm going to do it, but I'm still going to do it because I want to see it.
That's kind of fun.
However, this sort of movie... As you might say,
it's a movie filmed version of like a stage production.
Yeah, from 2016,
and one of those very carefully filmed ones with like clearly there's multiple cameras. It's not just some student in front of the thing with a handheld.
No,
camera.
Like the director is like the director of the actual stage play
right.
and stuff like that.
It's really well done.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda as Hamilton. The cast is insane.
It is the it was the biggest musical. Like how long has it been going? 3-4 years more?
I think. 5, if I'm not mistaken. But I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, and you know, it's a topic that you wouldn't think is like a big, would be the biggest musical in America. Although, I wouldn't have thought probably that Les Mis, Once Upon a Time, would become it. Like, that sounds like really egregious, and yet it became that. Or Cats, for that matter.
But is the life of Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, a founding father era politician who doesn't quite have like the, like he has big achievements, but he doesn't like have the kind of like he was not president or anything like that. And he died in a duel.
Yep.
He had a compelling life, and there was a book about it that inspired Lin-Manuel Miranda to write this really amazing textured hip hop themed, but also very much a traditional musical in some ways, but with absolutely a hip hop inflection throughout. It's a tale of his life in all its ups and downs.
And I was surprised at how emotional it kind of hit me at times.
It's like universal themes.
Yep.
But like I think like the foremost one and like one of the ones that's the big takeaways is that he was an immigrant who was like not born of like what you would think of as like an obvious like road to riches or to power. His mother was, like, what, a prostitute,
yep.
I think? And did his father die young?
I believe he did.
I know that he had, like they raised funds for him to go to America, I think, from... Was it from Puerto Rico?
I'm not sure.
Or am I mixing up real-life Lin-Manuel Miranda stuff? Apologies if I'm getting that wrong. But he was a guy who, like, always had this, like, hunger for knowledge. Like, almost like this is a recurring theme in it, almost a desperate need to move forward, be the smartest guy in the room,
yep.
even if he's obnoxious. And
what was the you write like you there's no tomorrow or
yeah you always yeah you write like time is running out
yeah,
or something
time
like
is
that.
Running out.
This is a what they call a sung through musical. That means there's almost no dialogue that's not a song,
right?
And there are actually dozens of songs. Some of them are rather short. Some of them are longer.
For me, I've never listened to any of the songs. I've never listened to the soundtrack. I know a lot of people said you should listen to the soundtrack before seeing the film, or before seeing it. Mm-hmm.
There's a debate on that, and also on whether you should watch with subtitles, because there's a lot of flashy numbers and, like, pretty cool stage work. But I also had not heard it all the way through. friends sometimes listened to it in the car and stuff when I was around. And what I found is I don't like hearing that stuff out of context. Yeah. I think people, you know how people, some people don't like musicals. And I sometimes almost felt that way. I'm like, I don't want to hear a song that's like a big emotional song without knowing the context.
But now that you know that context.
Now I could listen to it like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't previously. And so I was actually a little resistant to it going in. I was like, man, everybody thinks this is such hot shit. We'll see.
It's hot shit.
And it is pretty hot shit. But I'll tell you, I watched for like half an hour and I was like, oh, so there's some pretty good music here. I like what they're doing. But I wasn't super into it, and then like something kind of my defenses sort of fell down at some point. I think when they started doing the more emotional stuff in it, I got pulled in.
Yeah, there are definitely songs that resonated with me. There's also the Jonathan Groff who plays King George.
Oh my god,
his little musical interruptions like every once in a while.
Like everybody else in this is somebody who was either like a founding father or who's like basically friend of Hamilton's or rival.
You have Aaron Burr and John Adams and Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
The guy who plays Thomas Jefferson also plays Lafayette, I believe.
Yeah and I didn't know about this until Randy told me it to me yesterday. Several people play multiple roles.
Yeah, the guy who plays John Adams also plays Hercules, which I can never remember his last name.
It'll come to me.
But he... A lot of these people, it's interesting to see, have gone on to do other things. Like, the woman who plays Angelica was a major role in the Altered Carbon series that Netflix is doing.
Okay.
The guy who plays Hercules and John Adams is one of the best actors and a recurring role on the ABC show Station 19.
Okay.
Which is part of the whole Grey's Anatomy world.
And we mentioned, King George is the lead actor. Hercules Mulligan, by the way.
Hercules Mulligan.
Is the lead actor on a Mindhunter, serial, the kind of quasi-historical serial killer profile story from Netflix.
Yeah, and he was also on Glee.
Yeah, so Randy told me he came from that background.
Yeah.
So as a framing device, every once in a while, King George, both before and after the sort of revolution is won, will come out and give his kind of thoughts on things. And he is hilariously pompous.
Yep.
And his, like, he gets actually some very catchy songs.
Yes.
His particular pompousness is great to watch.
The rhythms of his songs are so cool, though.
Yeah. You know what, actually, this is something else I wanted to mention, is the supporting cast, which include basically like his drinking buddies and who are also like kind of political allies as he rises through the ranks because he is super ambitious.
Yep.
They everybody gets a great song.
Yeah.
So I was going to say Aaron Burr, his political rival, a guy who kind of like Salieri in the movie Amadeus, if you've seen it, was like accomplished but kind of super jealous, right? Yep. He's super jealous of him, and he feels like he doesn't have the drive, and he doesn't have the drive of Alexander Hamilton. But he gets a great... He gets a couple great numbers that did give him some texture so that he's not just the villain. And one of my favorite songs, The Room Where It Happens, is a big... it's basically like his motivation laid bare, but it's also about, like, backdoor political dealings and what kind of, like, you know, how you... What you give away when no one else is around, you know, what kind of deals you make. Super good song, but, like, even, like, so Hercules Mulligan and Lafayette, everybody gets some song that they get to shine in, even if they don't carry the whole song.
And Hamilton's wife, Eliza.
Yep.
She's really great.
And her sister.
And her sister, Angelica. I read an article last night about the woman who plays basically background actress, but she does like the bullet.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And a couple of other key things. She's deaf.
Oh, wow.
And I hadn't, when I read that she is acting as sort of like deaf in various spots because she's the one who has the bullet. She's the one who, like, meets Alexander Hamilton, takes Alexander Hamilton's son.
Yeah.
And it's like, she is actually the personification of death throughout the entire thing. And I'm like, holy crap, there's so many layers to this.
I just today saw... There's a song in it about the rules of dueling.
Yep.
I saw there's a guy who's like doing this...
10 Steps of Dueling.
YouTube series where he analyzes each of the songs, or at least maybe some of the major ones. And he was showing how this song... Do you want to talk about layers? There is all this crazy layering in just the way the way that they stage that song in the musical framework, what kind of music they're using. Like that song, that one song alone had all this depth. Sometimes that was came from the original, like Lin-Manuel Miranda, but he has some collaborators. And sometimes they added something, and it can come down to is like even the sound that they used for a bullet shot at one point, they changed it after like some stagings of it to a slightly different sound, and they said the audience audibly reacted differently to it, and they're like, oh, we're gonna go with this now. So there's just an infinite level of detail in this, and like a lot of the songs sort of function on multiple levels and have different meanings.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, you know, so the hip hop element that's in this, there's like, I think like people like traditional musicals will still like it.
Yeah.
But there is a hip hop element that really gets energized when Thomas Jefferson comes back from France. It's Thomas Jefferson, right?
Yeah.
And he's been hanging out in France for a few years, and he basically has a rap battle with Alexander Hamilton as they both square off, and they are both great. They look like they're kind of having the time of their lives, and sometimes it's serious and sometimes it's fun. But, man, it's like a shot in the arm to the whole production, which is a little long. It is like close to 3 hours.
Yeah, it's 2 hours and 45 minutes, I believe, is what my computer told me when I asked.
Yep. The staging is so elaborate on it that I do feel like if I were to have seen it and paid $1,000 or whatever, say I had that money to throw around, I probably would feel like I had gotten my money's worth, because it is an all-out kind of production.
But it is a one-stage thing. They have this revolving element to the stage in the middle of it.
There's a lot of stagecraft to it, but and like that, like you said, there's a sequence where somebody during a duel, there's someone is shot, and they do like this sort of slow-mo bullet time effect. But and the rotating stage is used in a lot of interesting ways. But yeah, it's mostly about like the stage, you know, the actors and stuff.
Yeah.
Who have to like do this every night or whatever and nail their bits.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, just sort of doing that myself. I mean, this repetition kind of, but they do an amazing job.
I don't know if we said this, but it's also funny.
It is. It's great.
There's a lot of funny stuff in it, so that you're not like you're not going to feel like you're getting some ponderous history lesson. What you're going to feel like is it's going to and it's a very multiracial cast that's meant to kind of bring the characters to life and make you see them anew, I think.
Yeah.
As well as clearly deliberately wanted to shake up our vision of what the Founding Fathers were. So, yeah, like Thomas Jefferson is like a superstar. I feel like he was like the dude from Outkast just walks in, and he's like, he's pompous and full of himself, and he's a match for Alexander Hamilton, who is also pompous and full of himself. But there's some swearing in it that's pretty funny, including one part where I think, is it when Aaron Burr reveals that he's secretly having an affair with a British officer's wife?
Yep.
And Hamilton is like, oh shit. And it's like, occasionally when there's just a little moment like that, that breaks from the musical stuff, it can be really funny and their timing is great.
I mean, I will say this. I didn't know if it was going to live up to the hype. It did. It even went beyond sort of what I was expecting.
I'd say kind of the same here. I'm going to throw out one or two criticisms real quick. I'm going to say it is a little long. I'm going to say I felt like...
It does cover a lot.
It covers a lot. The ending left me somehow slightly disappointed. Like, I almost felt like it needed maybe a little bit more of an epilogue or something.
Yeah.
Like, there is an epilogue of sorts, and you kind of find out what happened to some characters, and I like who does the last song and stuff, but there was something that felt like it didn't quite all come together for me there, even though a lot of the stuff in it did. I've definitely been, like, listening to the songs individually the last few days.
No, that's cool.
It's been stuck in my head.
Definitely going to return to watching this. Heck, I might even turn it on at the store just in a few minutes.
It's generally store safe, except for a few F-bombs, which they kind of mute out.
Yeah, they do.
But it, not so you don't know what they said.
I mean, if you have Disney Plus and you have, you know, you're quarantined or you're on lockdown or if you've got 3 hours.
No-brainer.
This is a no-brainer. Watch it. Watch with your kids. I think this is an amazing kind of entry-level look at this history.
Yeah, I think that it will bring that sort of world to life in a way that they kind of can't imagine it would. I didn't quite think that it would.
No,
and they talk in detail, by the way, about some kind of a somewhat elaborate political things.
I learned a lot about our history that I did not know.
He kind of like set up the modern-day banking system.
Yeah.
there were these debates about where the capital was going to be then, and all of this stuff. And even the notion that dueling was such a codified thing that there was, like, not only was it, well, if not common, because it was illegal.
Yes.
But, like,
not in New Jersey, though.
It was regular enough that there were these rules for it where you would have a second in command, your second is what they call it, who would negotiate with their second and try and talk it down. And that if you don't want to, like, you really don't want it to people to die, you just want to show that you're honorable and, like, you can shoot up in the air, you don't have to try and hit them. Like, there's all these fascinating rules where, you know, it's kind of almost like a gentleman's honor thing. But it turns dark and scary in this one.
Yeah.
It's got some tear-jerky moments.
It does.
Anyway, yeah, I think we're both big recommendations on it. I know Randy, were he here, would be a big recommendation on it. Yep. And then say he hates DC.
And on that note, I think that kind of finishes up. Go watch Hamilton. Read some good books this week.
Yep. If you've watched Hamilton, drop us a line. Let us know in the subject line, I've watched Hamilton. And let us know what you think.
Until next time.
Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening!